Accession number 18022, Reel 1.
Ken Black, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Just outside Halifax, village called West Vale.
Which year was this?
1932.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in the Halifax area?
Yeah.
So you spent the war years in Halifax?
That's right, yeah. The early beginnings we spent at Harrogate, and then we moved over to West Vale during the war.
Any particular reason for that?
Yeah, my dad's job.
Did the war affect you very much as a teenager?
Well, everything was the war. I mean, it's all people talked about. Nearly everybody's family had some or the other in services, or some kind of service, or reserved occupations, and home guards, and fire watching at night, and that. The shortage of food as well, the rations, and the carry-on that people used to have to supplement the rations, and that. I mean, at that time, everybody was encouraged to have allotments. They ploughed fields up, many, many fields, and turned them into allotments. And there was always somebody, somewhere, could get, if you like to call it, on the black market, something that somebody else wanted. And so they exchanged it and swapped it and sold it and goodness knows what. And that's how you grew up, like.
Were you personally involved in any exchange of goods?
Well, basically, I was too young, but, I mean, same as one particular time, my mum used to have a big wicker basket, you know, for collecting the laundry in. And my dad put a white sheet in and said, come on, we're going on to a certain place. And we came back with half a goat in it. So they'd slaughtered half the goat and dressed it and things like that. And because what we didn't want was exchange for various other things. My mother, her father lived not 10 miles from here, out in the country, and he kept pigs. And they were allowed to keep so many pigs by the Ministry of, you know, whatever it was, food and that. But he always used to keep a couple of extra ones. And they were slaughtered at night when nobody were around, and the pork and everything were shared out, you know, in the family. And they used to swap pork for sugar and for tea and, you know, other things that were scarce like.
Was this acquiring half a goat illegal?
I don't really know, to tell you the truth. I mean, at that age, if your dad said, you know, come on and do this, you didn't query, you just went on and he went and did it, like.
Did you ever go short of any kind of food that you
sweets,
wanted?
Sweets and fruit. The people that lived next door but four to us, they were an Irish family that had lived in the UK for a long number of years. And one of their relations was a merchantman. And he once came home and brought a box of oranges. And a lot of the children then had never seen oranges. You know, the small children had never seen oranges. And so Mrs. Duig, they called her, she shared the oranges out with the kiddies that, you know, lived around. And that. Sometimes it'd bring bananas home and, you know, things like that. Just couldn't buy them in shops and that.
You mean he was in the merchant navy?
He was a merchant man, yeah, yeah.
Did you experience any bombing by the German Air Force?
Not the amount that you got in, same as Sheffield, Hull and places like that. We had some dropped in the next field to us. But the field was on the hill, and we lived on the hills at the, you know, it was cut out on the hillside, So all we got was the shrapnel. And as kiddies, it were great scrambling around in the field looking for pieces of shrapnel and that. Halifax were bombed at one time. They killed quite a few. They hit a pub. I can't remember what they call it now. Somewhere up King Cross it was. I don't know. They killed about a dozen people or something like that.
What did you want with the shrapnel?
Well, kiddies collected things like that. I mean, you collected cap badges and all sorts of things like that. I had an uncle that came home once and he brought me a little box of goodies, and there were German buttons in, German cap badges in, and swastika armbands and all sorts of things. You know, that was a fad in those days to collect things like that. There used to be a railway station in Westvale, and I don't know what they were doing there, but they once had some Belgian soldiers come, and they sat outside railway station drinking tea and, you know, their rations and that. And as kiddies, and that everybody made a dash for them, and that, you know, begging cap badges and that were saying buttons and odd coins and all sorts like that.
Did the war affect your education at all?
No, I don't think so. No. I just went to a normal, whatever they call it. They used to call it a council school. And at 11, if you passed the exam and you could afford the uniform, you went to either a college or a technical college. But things were more difficult during the war and that, so I just finished school and went to work.
Was the war a miserable time or an exciting time for you?
For kiddies, it was an exciting time. It was miserable for the parents. My dad lost his brother at Dunkirk, and although that was the only one that was lost out of both families, one of my mother's brother was dropped at Arnhem and were very badly hurt. He never did another jump after that. But apart from that, the Uncle Bernard was the only one that were killed.
Were there any celebrations in your area when the Second World War finished?
Yeah, street parties. And not anything organised officially, but, you know, the parents did it, and you know, various people and that just got together, and street parties, and knocked a bit of a parade up and things like that. I mean, probably in Halifax itself, that may have been different to that. They may have been more organised there, but I mean, it was very rare we ever went into Halifax, only, you know, for odd shopping and that.
What did the street parties consist of?
Well, food was scarce and that, so basically were home-baked buns and, you know, kind of meat-paste sandwiches and Spam sandwiches and things like that.
Was there anything specially laid on for men who came back?
Not that I know of. No, they just seemed to drift back and drift into work and, you know, take things up as they had done before they left, kind of thing. As I say, we've been obviously, if I was born in 32, in 42 I was only 10. So it was listening to what your parents, you know, said and things like that. I can remember my dad used to keep clippings out of paper, how to load a rifle, how to load a magazine. They used to publish these things in the paper for people to clip out and keep at home in case, you know, there was an invasion.
How did you join the army yourself?
Oh, I went to work in the mill. And my dad was the chauffeur for the mill, and I worked there about, well, from 14 to 17. And we had a new manager, and I didn't get on very well with the new manager. And so I decided I wasn't going to work at mill anymore. And I had to go to my dad and tell him that I didn't want to work anymore at this particular mill. So he asked me why, and I told him. It was quite a long story, like, but anyway, I told him, and he said, well, it's up to you, like. He said, but what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. I said, I've no idea. I said, oh, well, I'll join the army if you let me. So he said, well, if that's what you want to do, do it. And at that time, a friend of mine was in the Navy, an artificer's apprentice, and so call him Robert George, who were killed later on. Nothing to do with the war and that, but so we went to Huddersfield, and I went into the recruiting office, and I said, I'd like to join the army. And they said, yeah, how old are you? I said, 17. Oh, they said, no, you're too young, you've got to be 17 and a half. I said, I don't want to wait 6 months, because that time 6 months seemed like a lifetime. So the recruiting sergeant said, So have you got any relations that were in the army? I said, yeah, I've got lots of them. Like. Is there anybody that lives local? I said, yeah. An auntie that lived in that was in ATS, and her husband were in Medical Corps. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, have a walk around the building. And he said, if you're 17 and a half when you come back, he said, we'll get things going. So I did. Walked out with Bob George, and we had a walk around Huddersfield, and I went back, and they said, what do you want? I said, I'd like to join the army. He says, how old are you? I said, 17 and a half. Oh, right. He says, when's your birthday? And it stuck. I hadn't added the 6 months on then. So he says, oh, I'll tell you when your birthday was. He says, it was 22nd of the 10th, 31. And so it just went on from there.
What day was this then?
About the 28th of March, 1949.
What was the next step?
Catterick. He said, when did I want to go? I said, as soon as possible. And I believe that was on the Wednesday or Thursday. And Monday morning, I was at Huddersfield railway station catching a train to Catterick. That was including having to go to Halifax for a medical. And of course, at Halifax, they said, well, why didn't you come and see us if you wanted to join the army? And I said, I didn't know where the recruiting office was in Halifax, but I knew where it was in Huddersfield. And so off I went to Catterick to do basic training and operator's course.
What was the basic training like?
Crude, I think, is the word. Yeah, crude. They chase you up and down from pillar to post. And at that time, there was a lot of national servicemen going in. And like I was like a lot more. It was the first time I'd been away from home. So it was a right eye-opener. Having to learn to press uniforms and bull boots and blanco kit and polished brasses and, you know, the general training, physical training and square bashing and inspections, and well, it was a right eye-opener.
How were you treated by the people in charge?
The language they used was abusive. It could make grown tears come to grown men's eyes, but after a while you got used to it, and it were like water off a duck's back. Some people found it very offensive. Other people, after a while, they actually got used to it. I mean, they used to come and stand and squeal right in your ear, oh, what a dirty, horrible, filthy little man you were, and you weren't fit to be on this earth, and They would make you a soldier if it were the last thing they did, and if it were last took their last breath and your last breath. And
What rank were they?
Mostly junior NCOs, lance corporals, full corporals, and sergeants. Very few staff sergeants. They only appeared later on, and because if you saw the RSM, you would walk miles out of his way, because everybody were he would have figurehead terrified everybody.
Do you think the basic training was of any benefit to
you? Yes. Oh, yeah. Afterward, I think it were the idea behind the system, looking back on it, it were, if you like to call it, they terrorised you, but they moulded you through the, all the carry-on. They moulded you into what they wanted, was a soldier. Be it a partly trained soldier. I mean, when you finished your basic training, you weren't a fully trained soldier, but you'd done the basic training, which it was called basic training. Drilling, firing rifles, brain guns, throwing the odd grenade, and learning how to look after yourself. I mean, some people, as daft as it sounds, they wouldn't wash, and they had to be told to wash themselves in the morning and shave and, you know, keep themselves clean and send you dirty washing to laundry and things like that. They were incredible, as some people. There was everything came together. I don't know the bloke's name. We had a guy from, he'd lived in way, way, way out in the Hebrides, and he barely spoke English because he mostly spoke Gaelic. And he'd never been on a train before, so God knows what it must have been to him. And there was such a a mishmash of, you know, everybody, as though they'd cast the net and trawled everybody in.
How did the different recruits get on with each other?
Well, after the shock of sleeping in a barrack room with umpteen people, when it came to, because you were shown how to do the various tasks you were given, you know, to bull your boots up and things like that, and obviously it's like anything else, there were always somebody better than others, and often they would chip in and show you, no, you do it this way, it's better, and things like that, and people, you found it a level, a natural level.
Did you have second thoughts about having joined the army at this
stage? I did, at that particular stage, yes, I did. The first, shall we say, 3 weeks, yes. I thought, God, I've let myself in for 5 years of this.
And after the basic training?
Well, during the basic training, they gave a little trade test, which a chimpanzee could do, really. And through that, they said to you, they asked you what you wanted to be, and then they told you what you would be doing. And I asked to be a radio operator, because my dad had always been interested in radios and that. And if you pass this test with enough marks, you got to be what you wanted. You had the choice of a driver, a gunner, or operator, because it was you were being trained for an armoured regiment. And if there were some people that were, for lack of other words, so dense, they were no good for anything but general duties. And general duties were the fatigues, you know, just cookhouse fatigues and various things like that, which I wouldn't have fancied things like that for 5 years. But when you went to, they moved you out of the basic training area up to whatever, either the gunnery wing or the radio wing, and the discipline was a lot less there. You were basically, they wanted you basically to learn to do what you was going to be trades. They weren't interested as much in the spit and polish, Although you had to be clean and tidy and smart and that. And you got to, after you'd done so many weeks radio training, they used to pop you into 1500 weights and you used to drive around the North Yorkshire area sending radio messages to one another and picking them up, you know, all part and parcel of the training. So often you got half a day at the seaside at Redcar or somewhere like that, which, you know, it was good.
And then, what happened to you next?
Well, halfway during the radio operators course, there were a dock strike on. And so we all went down to work on docks for 6 weeks. They interrupted the radio course and they opened a disused army camp at just outside Grays, other side of London somewhere, near Pearlbright somewhere in that area.
Near Tilbury.
Yeah. And we during the day they used to pick us up in a wagon and bring us into Tilbury docks, and we used to work as stevedores on there and then take us back at night. We did that for 6 weeks.
What exactly did you have to do?
Unload ships.
Carrying things?
Depended on the ships. There were various ships and that. Some of them, one of them was tractors from America, and so you just were down in the hole with four big hooks and you stuck a, each one stuck, there were four of you and you stuck a hook under each and they craned it up. Another hold, probably on the same ship, was 56-pound boxes of lard. And you unloaded them on a pallet and then the crane dropped the hooks in and you hooked and he lifted it up and deposited it on the lorry side where somebody loaded the lorry. Unloaded tin fruit, frozen rabbits, ingots of lead, sugar, a white sugar. I don't know really what that was, but various, depending on different ships, was, you know, what you unloaded, different things.
Did the soldiers do the job well?
Yeah, very well, yeah. The only thing is, the big tower cranes on the docks, obviously the crane drivers were on strike and they mostly brought people from the Navy to operate the cranes, and because they weren't as skillful as the normal operators, so, you know, you imagine the big hold and that, and they would bring it up and it would get it wrong and it would swing and it would probably catch and all tipple off and that. Everybody used to gallop out of the way. The holes on the ship, if you've never seen them, they are tremendous. I mean, they're not just the size of this little room. You could put this little room 30 times into some of the big holes.
Were there any accidents?
Nobody were, not that I know of, anybody being hurt, but it was surprising the number of cases of tin fruit that fell off, because you weren't allowed to take them out at the docks. But if they fell off while you were in there, everybody had a jackknife and used to sit there scoffing tins of peaches and all different fruits and that. But the MPs used to search you as you came out of the dock gates to get on the wagon, so it was hopeless trying to take anything out like tin fruit. And I mean, who wanted frozen rabbits? The wagon drivers did very well out of us, because they would come in with their wagons and there would be a junior NCO that was, they got like a tally clerk, and he would say, oh yeah, they want 50 boxes on here. So the blokes that were loading it didn't give a damn whether there were 50 or 60 boxes on. The guy would sign, the NCO would sign the ticket, and the lorry driver went off quite happy with probably 10 or 5 extra boxes on whatever it was.
When was this?
1949. June, July, I think, something like that. I'm not right sure. Like.
Did you have any aggravation from the dockers?
No, they were gems. The nearest place was Dagenham. and they used to take us in three tonners and drop us in Dagenham, and then you know, they'd say, right, we'll pick you up at 2300 hours, same place and that, and they were gems. We got invited to houses for Sunday dinner and taken out for drinks, and
even brilliant. Though you were doing their job,
yeah, not like this cold strike of 85.
Why did they have this attitude?
Because we couldn't help it. We had no choice in it. I mean, we were told to do it, and you had to do it. It was simple as that. You know, no choice at all. But they were brilliant with the people of Dagenham.
Did you personally get invited?
Yes. Yeah. I wrote to this girl for quite a while. I've forgotten her name now. I can remember some of the address, but I can't remember all of it. Yeah, and her dad was a docker. And as I say, they were brilliant people.
How long did it go on for?
6 weeks. We were down 6 weeks.
How did you like doing it?
It was a change. It was different. I'm not right sure of the date, but it was in the summer. And it was very hot. And the meals used to come in containers. You know, these hot and cold boxes. And we used to sit on the barges on the riverside, eating out of, you know, it all went into mess tins and that. And we used to sit on the barges and have us dinner out the mess tins and that.
What happened to you next?
We came back to Catterick to finish the radio operator's course, because it had been interrupted by the dock strike.
And by the time you finished the course, what were you qualified to do then?
Operate a 19 set, which was the standard AFV radio and other branches use the radio. We weren't taught Morse. It was all, speech, radio, telephony. And when we'd finished the course, you went for an interview, and they said, right, what regiment do you want to go in? And everybody, some had ideas, some didn't. And I said, I'd like to go in Royal Scots Greys. And they said, no vacancies, it's full. So I said, well, what do you do now? They said, well, it's the best thing to do. He said, is go into holding troop. And he said, as a regiment says they want so many men, they take them off the top of the troop and everybody moves up and, you know, it goes like that. And while you were in holding troop, you just did fatigues and that, you know, sweeping roads, picking papers up, washing pots and pans in cookhouse and cleaning sergeant's mess and things like that. And then when you finished, you came for your tea, you know, to pick your knife, fork and spoon up to go cookhouse for your tea, and then you would look at the list on the holding troop to see if your name was on. And that particular time we had a look, and there was about 40 odd of us all going to 8th Hussars. And of course everybody wanted to know who 8th Hussars was and where they were, but nobody known them. Nobody knew them very well, because prior to the Second World War, they'd served such a long time.